Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Speaking in Maine brings you public policy lectures, debates, and panel discussions from across Maine. Speaking in Maine today takes us to the University of New England's Portland campus to hear David Brancaccio, host of American Public Media's Marketplace Morning Report, delivering the university's 10th annual Paul D. Merrill Business Ethics Lecture.
Yeah, you got to hand it to a college that gives the status of dean to their IT professional. I have just spent the last month interviewing robots. One was a heavy metallic snake robot about the length of a baseball bat. The snake robot was ordered to wrap tightly around my ankle and shinny up my thigh. And then it got up to the top and with its little camera head started looking around at my belt line. Was it creepy? I vote yes. Can we humans learn something from these and other robot experiences? I vote yes. I am very honored to have been invited to share some thoughts as part of this lecture series in honor of Paul D. Merrill. It's great to be back in Maine. And I know I don't quite sound like a Mainer, but give me two beers and I promise you, you'll know I am from central Maine. I stumbled across a cassette of one of my early radio broadcasts from a wonderful pair of stations in Waterville, WTVL, AM and FM. And it was, I think, the President Ford administration. That's how old I was 15. And even then, no beer whatsoever. You can hear me saying, here's the latest WTVL weather brought to you by the Waterville Savings Bank, the family bank, now paying interest daily on all regular savings accounts at the rate of 5.25%. If you're under the age of 50, a passbook savings account that pays 5.25% must seem like science fiction. That was actually true. Looking back across the Paul D. Merrill speakers over the years, and it's been an amazing bunch, I certainly feel not worthy. It is this wonderful line of accomplished business leaders and thinkers who have urged audiences here to go deeper in their thinking, to wrestle with ways to ensure that we increase the chances of doing what is right and lower the chances of doing what is wrong. Did you see in the news this week, how could you miss it, the big court case involving overtime pay at the dairy here in Maine? It turned on one measly piece of punctuation, the so-called Oxford comma. Did you see this in the news? Comma, comma, and, or no comma, and? Well, in my line of work, which is also not just about the written language, it's also about spoken language, you know, radio, TV, podcasts. It's not just the punctuation. It's certainly also about inflection that can get you. So I've got this little title here from my talk that I had offered, From Self-Driving Cars to Self-Driving Business Ethics. But looking through the list of the wonderful P.D. Merrill lectures from the past years, to my concern and surprise, I saw that here 4 years ago, in this series, bioscientist David Barber's lecture title was, and I quote, Ethics in Driving Decisions. Oh no, same topic? It's about the inflection. Dr. Barber's lecture was Ethics in Driving Decisions. Different, so I'm not going to step on that one. And this is hopefully a new theme. Now, you know how, when public speaking, you're supposed to start a talk with a laugh line, right? Here goes. We are living in a golden age of ethics. In the spring of 2017, I think we are living in a golden age of ethics, and I'm going to try to develop that theme. Now, I know, looking at this sea of faces, this ocean of skepticism when I said that, you know, your thoughts are being drawn to what's going on in Washington, D.C. And I am just back from a road trip. I started in western Pennsylvania, went clear across Ohio into Michigan, the northern tip of Indiana into Chicago, Illinois, then up to Wisconsin. 92% of those were counties that I think went to President Trump during the election, 1,200 miles of this. And I talked to a lot of people along the way who think the president is doing a fine job. I met a lot of other people on the same road trip who do not share this view. I would say it's too early to write the ethics history of this administration or about the lasting ethical implications of a businessman as chief executive of the country who has lawyers who argue that the president does not have to sever all ties with his global businesses and that we must think differently this time about the idea of conflicts of interest if we have a president with this kind of business background. Now, I majored in history, and maybe I will write the book someday. My early feeling is that Trumpian ethics not only will be the title of somebody's very thick book eventually, I predict that Trumpian ethics will become a phrase based on the name, like Darwinian or Byronic or maybe Orwellian. Note also that the word chauvinistic comes from a gentleman named Nicholas Chauvin. Trumpian ethics. What are other names turned into adjectives? Wagnerian, Dickensian, Faustian, Kafkaesque. Smithsonian doesn't work. Back to my thesis. This is a golden age of ethics. How do you like them inflection? I will argue this is true because right now we are actively and vigorously trying to teach ethics to machines. As robots, artificial intelligence, algorithms, and software increasingly make autonomous decisions, we need to tell the machines what is the right decision and what is the wrong decision. And here's the thing. I believe that teaching machines ethics is not a one-way street. I want to suggest that as we try to teach machines how to behave, we humans will also be on a voyage of discovery about how we should behave. To teach a machine ethics, we have to understand our own ethics. I think this will inform how we want ourselves to behave in business and how we want ourselves to behave in life. Now, the need to apply ethics to technology is not new. Let's say you're engineering a new high-performance car engine or something. Car companies have an engineer who has to choose for a particular model how much power versus how much fuel efficiency versus how much pollution. You can make an engine sip fuel but belch nitrogen oxides or sulfur dioxides. You can make an engine so tremendously powerful to the point that it's dangerous to drive and drinks enough gas to suck the shale dry out of North Dakota. So applying ethics to machines is not new. What is new is that computer processing power and other advances in technology will increasingly allow machines to make decisions for themselves, far removed or completely removed from human intervention. This is everywhere, my friends. Just think of medical devices. Just think of caregiver robots. For years, they've been working hard to develop caregiver robots in Japan, in particular, in part driven by demographics. Japan has an aging population with a need to help care for elderly for as long as possible in the older adult's own home. So they're trying to get robots to do that. Last week, on a video conference call, I was able to meet a kind of robot being developed in Israel that helps older adults do their social media, take their pills on time, get up and get exercise. The robot's name was LEQ. It's not quite on the market yet. So you start to see where this is going, I think. In the medical literature, there's already an emerging discussion about the ethics of these companion robots. It's already been shown that people bond emotionally with the robots with which they spend time. There are documented cases of policemen breaking down into tears when their bomb disposal robot gets blown up. There are plans to make robots into companions, intimate companions in the medical context, for some people with disabilities. I don't mean to shock you, but experts are thinking now about the ethical rules for sex robots prescribed by a doctor. What if the software allows these companion robots to simulate a real relationship to the point that the patient falls in love with the device to the exclusion of human relationships? Perhaps you've seen the movie Her with Joaquin Phoenix, right? The resonant voice of Scarlett Johansson, who plays a voice companion like Apple's Siri version 11.0. What ethical rules should apply once Scarlett's voice isn't just a voice in a phone, but attached to a robot? First, it'll look like C-3PO, no big deal, but eventually a Westworld kind of robot. Ethicists right now are working on this problem of just how deeply these devices should be allowed to get into people's heads. You have lived long enough to see this become an issue. Congratulations. Turning from medical tech to military tech, drones, tanks, then robots that can go off and decide what to destroy, what to kill, and what not to touch. The kill-no-kill decision will eventually reside within the device with no final human interaction. Presumably, these robots would be filled with software that reflects the legal rules of engagement. When these go wrong, the question becomes, who is liable? The Pentagon? The commander-in-chief? The corporation? The contractor that built the robot? The engineer who programmed it? What if there are 100 engineers? I spoke about this with a philosophy professor the other day, and good professor that she is. The professor challenged me to also consider the idea that the autonomous drones, tanks, artillery pieces, the autonomous robot soldiers might have an advantage, not falling prey to human frailties, such as anger, vengeance, fatigue, and might be less likely to commit, for instance, war crimes, less likely than human soldiers. I'm not sure about that, given the history of how carnage in wartime is sometimes more tolerated when it's at arm's length, air power versus armed hand-to-hand combat. Medical, military. Let's get to an area of technology where the golden age of ethical exploration is already right now in full bloom. AVs, autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars. It's not science future here, it is science now. You think everyone here, in a sense, I think everyone here looking at you, I think you all have a self-driving car already. Engineers rate autonomous cars on an ascending scale, 0 to 5. My first cars were level zeros, not autonomous. They didn't have cruise control, ABS braking. But just about all of you, if not all of you, drive not level zero, but level one autonomous cars. You can lock in the speed. You probably have ABS, brakes, electronic stability control, which has saved more lives than any car invention since the seatbelt. Some of you may have level three self-driving cars, the ones that help keep you in your lane by grabbing your steering wheel when you stray. Or, I gotta love that one, adaptive cruise control, where you dial in the following distance. My buddy in Oakland, Maine, from Oakland, Maine, doesn't live in Oakland anymore, he's got a Chevy Volt electric car that parallel parks by itself. Look, Ma, no hands. I don't know how often he's really going to use it. It's a really cool party trick the first time. And any self-respecting Mainer knows how to parallel park anyway. But you know where this is going. Level 5, eventually, is you sitting in the back watching Netflix or Facebooking, buttering your croissant, flossing maybe, tweezing. The technology's already here. The other day I was in Pittsburgh. I sat in a Cadillac SRX SUV the other day. It's at Carnegie Mellon. This car happily drove by itself from Cranberry, Pennsylvania, about 33 miles to the Pittsburgh International Airport, cruised Washington, D.C. without crashing into anyone or anything as well. And what was cool about that robot Cadillac is that it didn't look weird. No strange electronic headdress or little pod fixtures sticking out the side. Inside, the infotainment screen could be switched over from your tunes to have this kind of laser-guided LiDAR tracking system. And there was this big, explodey-looking red button right in the middle of the dash that said, emergency. But other than that, it looked like a normal vehicle. CMU engineering professor Raj Rajkumar sat in that autonomous vehicle with me and told me that someday people will relate to these cars as they do a trusted companion. Think Morgan Freeman, he said, or Jessica Tandy. The professor conjured the image of driving Miss Daisy, with the car itself playing the role of both chauffeur, concierge, and wise sage, confidant, An engineering professor really said this to me earlier this month. What is not here now, what we don't have, because the cars can drive themselves now, what we don't have are the rules that will govern how robot cars will behave in complex situations. You know, in city traffic, when a human driver has to make that excruciatingly tough decision about whether to cross the intersection ahead of a yellow light, block the box in a New York City, it's a $115 fine. And we've seen this. The cops just stand there with scanners. New York registered cars have barcodes in the front. And they nail you, they hand you the ticket, and you drive on one after the other. Problem is, in the box, if you're too patient, relaxed, timid, defensive driver, the other jerk scoots in ahead of you, the box still gets blocked, and you try to do the right thing, you end up going nowhere. Robot car engineers tell me that block the box, don't block the box, is a super tough one for automation. And raise that to, I don't know, the 12th power, and you get a sense of the engineering problems ahead for autonomous vehicles. They are engineering problems, but I'm here to tell you that they are thorny ethical problems as well. Some of you here have heard of what's called, do you know this one, the trolley problem? It's an ethical dilemma first posed in 1967. In this theoretical situation, you're on an out-of-control rail car, and if you do nothing, the trolley kills five people. If you do something proactively, pull the lever to switch rails, you kill just one person instead of five. But you just made a decision to kill that one person, so is that ethical? Just keep going straight, not your fault, trolley's broken, not your ethical problem, or is it? The trolley problem raised to the, I don't know, eighth power is what engineers and ethicists are facing with this emergence of self-driving cars. Ready for this wild ride, my friends? Here goes. Say there's a robot car with you, and you're in the back watching America's Got Talent or whatever on your flat screen, cruising along just below the speed limit prudently, minding your business, car's minding its business, and out of nowhere a truck cuts across your path. In 3/100ths of a second, the computer brain in this robot car has to decide, hit the brakes hard, but crash into the truck. Your car knows you'll probably break a few bones, but you won't die. Or your car could decide to swerve hard to one side, missing the truck. You won't get hurt at all, but you'd hurt a motorcyclist, probably badly, because the car will detect that this motorcyclist was wearing no helmet. Or your car could swerve hard in the other direction, missing the truck, missing the motorcyclist with no helmet, but instead choosing to hit another motorcyclist on the left who is slightly more likely to survive the crash because he is wearing a helmet. There's some logic to this, but there's no logic to this. Should the car protect the occupant at all costs? Should the car turn into the guy who took the precaution of wearing a helmet because he has better chances of survival? But if every motorcyclist knew the robot cars were being programmed to come after them as a matter of ethics, to run them down, would they stop wearing helmets? And more people would die. Car companies right now in 2017 have hired ethicists and philosophers to help them figure out how to proceed. I mean, I know this is wild. I know you found the last example unsettling as I did, but I can make this even worse. Truck pulls out in front of your robot car. Car has to decide whether to run over the lady on the right, who is presumably closer to the end of her useful contributions to the economy because the car detects that she's got a walker and looks elderly, versus hitting the kid on the left, the kid who has many years of productive economic life and might discover the cure for cancer, you never know. Yet, who knows the answer to all of these thorny ethical questions? Someone knows the answer. Mercedes-Benz knows the answer. The CEO of Mercedes, I know you're not going to believe me, you're going to go look this up, he's making this up. The CEO of Mercedes has come out and said flatly that Mercedes-Benz will engineer its cars to save the occupants every single time. No utilitarian philosophy for these Mercedes. Self-protection is the way, according to these folks. I suppose they should mount a bulldozer blade on the front of all their cars while they're at it, protecting the car's occupants. Guiding a decision like this isn't just Guiding a decision like this isn't just the sense of entitlement that many German luxury car owners are presumed to have. I knew I was going to have fun saying that line. I own a Chevy, but I also own a German one of these cars, so forgive me. Independent researchers did a series of surveys asking people about driving situations like the motorcycle or trolley problem. What is the most ethical choice, people are asked in these surveys? Most people say the most ethical choice is for the car to be engineered to cause the least injury, the least loss of life, even if that means the car's occupants get hurt or die. What is the most ethical choice? Do the least damage to society at large. People think that's the most ethical, that this is the right answer. But listen to this. When those same people are asked, would you yourself buy a self-driving car that is engineered to be ethical like that? Most people say, no, they would not buy a car that fails to give priority to the occupants of the vehicle. Think about it. The occupants of the vehicle aren't just you. They're your loved ones. They're your family members, your kids. Even if the car kills 10 people, isn't that worth your son or daughter surviving? That is an example of the horrible, stark choices that this technology presents us with. And this is one of the things we love about ethicists. They push you to consider more deeply the even wider consequences of your actions. One of the strongest arguments for self-driving cars is the lives that that technology will save. 35,000 people die every year in motor vehicle accidents in this country. More than 90% of those accidents are caused by human error. If autonomous vehicles can radically reduce the error rate, then tens of thousands of lives could be saved every year. All right. And Mercedes is arguing that if consumers are leery about buying cars that are not set up to favor the safety of the occupants, then they won't buy them. And if they don't buy them, there will be fewer robot cars on the road, and if there are fewer robot cars on the road and more humans, there will be more fatal human mistakes. Mercedes, Audi, and some other companies have said that they will assume, at least for now, at least in the early years of this, they will assume legal responsibility for decisions made by their self-driving cars. But that still, I don't think, absolves the individual of ethical responsibility here, right? Consumers will have to make a choice about which model cars to buy, robot versus non-robot, cars set up to favor self and family protection versus utilitarian robot cars that do what's best for society. If that sounds strange, remember that we're making those consumer decisions even now. We're making ethical decisions about our cars now. Maybe someone here wants to buy a smaller Prius that's better for the environment, or a bigger SUV that will win in a crash with a smaller car. But also the SUV has the higher risk to rolling over in a crash, but that's a different discussion. I was thinking about this. Maybe that's the one that's the development from the Merrill lecture of this year, this concept. Maybe you could dial in the ethics of your robot to the car. You decide, the same way you decide whether you're going to turn the car into the sport mode or turn off the skid control so you can do a little drifting like the movie Fast and Furious. Or maybe when you buy the car initially at the dealership, you choose the ethics then. Maybe you make the choice as a consumer. Depending on which car you buy, the Subaru might come equipped to avoid wildlife. The Volvo will come set to mow down anything in its path as long as everyone inside is okay. One roboticist I talked to about this blanched at this idea of dialing in the ethical profile of the car, worried about the legal liability that would fall upon the driver owner of the vehicle. And he thought the way this will proceed is that some agreed industry and legal standards will emerge over time. I extrapolate from this and wonder if we could dial in the preferred ethics for the companies that we invest in. It would be a shareholder proxy thing, perhaps. Driverless cars will become ubiquitous. We're not sure exactly when. A roboticist, when asked about this, said when engineers are uncertain about a time frame, they always say, about 20 years. That's when they don't know. Elon Musk at Tesla thinks it'll be in 10 years. A professor of autonomous vehicle engineering told me that within two generations, so a while from now, two generations, driving a car will be illegal in America. As a person who feels they'll have to pry his car from his bony dead hands, I must have made a face at this illegal in two generations prediction, because the professor went on to reassure me that that's okay, relax. If my descendants still wanted to drive in the future, they would be able to go to a ranch, some place where you could drive a car in a controlled course, like I might go to a dude ranch to try out a horse. Oh, what a prospect. But if it would save tens of thousands of lives a year, all right. In all this talk about the thorny ethics of machines, what about my thesis that teaching machines to behave ethically can at the same time help humans act ethically in our personal lives and in our business lives? If you're taking notes and not scanning your Instagram feed over there, the man at the podium just restated his thesis, so mark that down. When researchers ask people how they want their robot cars to behave, they say ethically, defensively. When asked about their own personal car shopping preferences, no, actually, when asked about their own personal car driving manners, how they themselves drive, people say they want their robot cars to be respectful of other cars and pedestrians and not to drive aggressively as if there's a jerk behind the wheel. They want their cars to give priority to the owner-occupants in the very rare cases when a car is faced with stark choices. But generally, they want their self-driving cars to play nice. But I have to tell you, those researchers also ask those same people how they themselves drive the cars. Ethically and defensively? Not always, not mostly, not really. The research suggests that we want our robots to act ethically, but even though we ourselves aren't acting all that ethically. And that, my friends, is useful information that we as individuals, we as people in businesses and organizations, can act on to improve our own ethical behavior. We're trying to teach cars to do the right thing. That challenge means we have to know what the right thing is. The process of determining the right thing, the ethical thing, is, I think, a teachable moment. Actually, I would argue that it's an ongoing teachable process. We've entered a period where we are formalizing ethical rules, turning ethics from, I don't know, playing jazz music, where we kind of feel it out, we intuit. We find the right way forward based on experience and practice. We pick up the vibe, and we are moving to a place where ethics might be more akin to playing classical music, where the rules are more formal. They're more formal because we now have to teach them to machines. The late 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant might be on my side on what I'm about to say. Aristotle, the 4th century BC guy, would not agree with what I'm about to tell you. As Sharon Lloyd, noted professor of philosophy at the University of Southern California, reminded me the other day, she's the one philosopher I have on speed dial on my phone, so I called her. She's brilliant. Professor Lloyd said Aristotle believed that ethics is not what a programmer here in the 21st century might call a decision tree. It's not, Aristotle would think. If A, then B, if C, then D. Not Aristotle. He believed that ethics is the result of accumulated experience, a product of wisdom acquired over time. To be ethical, you have to study wise men, wise women. That's how you do it, thought Aristotle. Incidentally, when I was working on a PBS special about climate change and water scarcity and glaciers, I climbed high in the Himalayas and met the proverbial wise man who lives at the top of the world dispensing wisdom. It's in that New Yorker cartoon every 2 weeks. Dispensing wisdom to pilgrims like me. The wise man I found at 15,000 feet was, of course, a woman, not a man. No beard, but very wise, a woman named Priya, a 50-something former Indian school teacher who had moved to a cave at 15,000 feet above the glacier, which is the source of the Ganges. So just letting you know, Aristotle might have framed it in gender-specific terms. I'd like to challenge that. But this Aristotelian notion of learning over time, accumulating from experience and the skill, the ability to tell right from wrong, pivots on the idea that ethics is complicated because there are so many facets to consider. When it comes to business ethics, many also believe that ethics is not a programmable decision tree, but something that comes with experience, which would conform to Aristotle's way of thinking. I recently got a briefing from a man named Michael McMillan, who helps teach business ethics at the CFA Institute, the organization that certifies financial investment professionals. I asked Mr. McMillan about the hyperlinked apps that he must use to help people learn to behave ethically in their organizations, to do the right thing more often. Mr. McMillan does use some technology to tell stories about ethical dilemmas in business, but it turns out he rejects the notion of ethics as a relatively simple decision tree. Take the case, he said, of an employee ordered by the immediate supervisor to photocopy proprietary company documents because the supervisor is quitting and wants to take the documents with her. He poses that to his students. In this situation, there's some ethical tension, I guess, not much. Obedience to authority, we're not allowed to be insubordinate versus the problem of helping the boss steal. Thou shalt not steal, so this doesn't seem like a tough dilemma. But Dr. McMillan, with his investment professionals in his course, makes the situation a little less abstract and a little more real world. How about this? The boss who is leaving, we now learn, is a mentor who's been good to you. She's quitting because she lost out due to unfair office politics. The boss is the sole breadwinner in her family and has a special needs child. Do you help copy the company files in that case? McMillan told me that many people, in that case, say yes, they would help. His point is that a computer program set up to follow formal ethical rules won't be equipped to handle this. Ethics is not a decision tree. The computer can handle the rule that honesty is the best policy. But what does the computer do if you ask, okay, but what is the second best policy? Dr. McMillan might not agree with my thesis that teaching machines to make ethically sound decisions would in turn teach us much in the real human world. But here is the thing. Drawn from my recent robot journey across many states, I was doing that because I'm doing a big series in a couple of weeks. It's going to be most of April, about technological unemployment. It's called robot-proof jobs. We're trying to keep it positive. Which are the better jobs to keep when robots are competing in the workforce alongside you? It's driven by the fact that our political discourse now is all about globalization and foreigners taking our jobs, and that we could bring factories back to the U.S., people would be better. That might be the case, but I think the technological stuff is actually a bigger challenge moving forward. So we're doing that series. That's why I've been talking to all these robots. Here's the thing. The technology is developing very, very quickly, and soon engineers assisted by philosophers and ethicists are no longer going to put ethical decision trees into machines. They'll be putting something much richer and much more advanced into the machines. This will happen when the machines become, wait for the phrase here, when the machines become what the experts call autonomous moral agents, AMAs. When the machines make decisions for themselves, they'll have to make moral decisions. And to see this as simply mechanical, I think is to misunderstand the lightning speed at which the technology is advancing right now. Take IBM's Watson, for example. There's news that the tax prep company H&R Block has hired Watson to do people's taxes. To me, that looked like a stunt. We already use software to do taxes. Now it's a little bit fancier computer. But when I asked an expert at MIT about this, he said, no, it's not a stunt. Watson can sort through a much more complicated array of possible choices and outcomes, a much richer set of choices than a human can in a very short amount of time. A machine that can consider a deep reservoir of choices. That sounds like what Aristotle thought a wise man or woman can do way better than a callow youth. This stuff is coming, my friends. And what Watson learns about ethical decision-making, I think, can help humans to understand the wider ramifications of our own human decisions. Back to the car crash optimization algorithm and variations on what's called that trolley problem, right, for self-driving cars. How the car learns to respond in an emergency situation could help us run organizations more ethically, I think. Here's an example from the broader business world. Your bank has purchased a pile of collateralized debt obligations that are now turning out to be riskier than the company thought. The choice is keep them on the books so that the employees and the shareholders, they get hurt. It's an option. Or you could unload these CDOs on a little city in Maine that was looking for an investment hedge. Or you could unload the CDOs on that pension plan, which by design would transfer the risk to elderly people. Another one, think of an agribusiness with a glut of corn on its hands. If they choose to store it in silos, it's an unproductive inventory that would hurt the occupants of, not the car, but hurt the occupants of the shareholders, the owners. Or they could sell it so it depresses the market price and hurts corn farmers. Or they could turn it into high fructose corn syrup that could make people fat, which is in turn linked to diabetes and higher healthcare costs to society. Folks like my new friend, Dr. McMillan at the CFA Institute, or indeed Aristotle himself, like to think that ethics starts with accumulating wisdom through experience, through training and practice. In a sense, acting ethically is like learning to be a kind of judge, as if these moments at the ethical crossroads when we have to decide right from wrong, we temporarily need to throw on a robe and take up a gavel. You can't be a great judge without experience, and we don't tend to appoint judges straight out of law school because it's not just about all the legal rules that you just learned in school. It's about the wisdom accumulated over time to put these rules together to prioritize. So you're probably thinking that one of the very last positions in society that can be taken over by robots is the role of the judge. A judge, unlike a paralegal, unlike a pharmacist, I saw the School of Pharmacy over there, I'll say it quietly, or unlike an assembly line worker, which are more vulnerable to technology, unlike them, judges don't have to worry about robot competition, or so I thought. Guess what artificial intelligence researchers have been working on to see if they can program a system to learn from human judges, to conduct what's called deep learning of judges' behavior over time to find the overt and the hidden patterns that add up to the legal wisdom that we expect of these folks, these judges. Professors at the University of College London fed into this software rig data from nearly 600 cases from the European Court of Human Rights. The artificial intelligence was taught to consider evidence as well as to identify and appreciate the implicit ethical rules that were being followed in the real cases. Then it asked this piece of equipment, this AI, to rule on the cases. Listen to this. The software predicted the actual outcome correctly in 79% of the cases. 79%. Does this mean human judges are on their way out? No, because technical feasibility is not the only factor in deciding when a robot wins in the workplace. Social acceptability is another key factor. We probably just don't want robots deciding. It's likely robot soldiers will happen way before robot police officers, which I just don't think society is ready to accept. But on this judge's thing, what about arbitrations and mediations? Might some or many of those dispute settlement arrangements get outsourced to an artificial intelligence at some point? Even if full-on robot judges are not in our future, trying to create them, experimenting with creating them, seems to me to be a useful exercise. Software that studies and tries to simulate the reasoning of, for instance, judges can identify not just the accepted rules, but also the hidden patterns of reasoning, including some patterns we would like to transcend or to eliminate. What if the deep learning discovers that the opinions of judges are sometimes subject to bias, racial bias, class bias? Daniel Kahneman, the Princeton professor, won the Nobel Prize in economics, once cited a study of parole judges in Israel. Turns out they tended to grant more paroles right after meal breaks, and they're more hard-ass when they're getting hangry before the meals. Statistically, it's unbelievable, but of course it's believable. My point here is that by identifying the stated legal rules and the hidden rules that govern a judge's work in an effort to program ethics into a machine, we're not just improving the software. We humans are learning information that could inform human judge behavior. Both the ethics of the AI and the ethics of the human judge are learning from the interaction. It's not hard to shift this from the courtroom to the boardroom and beyond. There's a company started by a person once described as the most powerful woman on Wall Street. Sally Krawcheck used to be at Citigroup. But it started something now called LVEST, E-L-L-E-V-E-S-T, LVEST. It's designed for mainly women to take control of their lives through their investments. You sign up for LVEST, and no salesman will call, as they used to say on TV. It's a web interface, what Wall Street now calls a robo-advisor. The software helps you define what you want out of life, how much money you need for whatever it is you want, assesses your risk profile, learns your time frame, and then offers some options for a portfolio. Thing about it is this: as robo-financial advisors become more common, they'll get more sophisticated, and the ethical rules that underpin them could reflect back on the rules that apply to human advisors. What do we expect of a human financial advisor? How will the ratio be set between serving the financial needs of the client and the financial needs of the firms selling the financial products? If that process is transparent and disclosed, you can foresee the financial industry growing and improving, humans learning from the act of programming their little robo friends. Earlier, I talked about programming ethics into medical devices for a second. In a way, the medical side of this has a firmer platform upon which to build the ethics for their machines. There's the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. And here's a truth that we don't reflect on enough. You ready for it? When it comes to the ethical decisions most companies make, there is no Hippocratic Oath. There's no pledge to do no harm. It's probably okay to harm, for instance, your competition, as long as it's legal. How much a business can harm the environment or harm family incomes by keeping wages down in the interests of the owner shareholders? Those are some of the ethical rules that would have to be identified if we were to ever try to build a robot compliance device to help ensure that the company isn't doing anything that puts an organization at an elevated risk of disaster over time. By the way, that's my little ethical rule I walk around with. I'm not sure I live up to it all the time. Ethics are about not doing anything that increases the risks of disaster over time. It's a variant on, are you doing something that wouldn't look good in the right-hand lead of the front page of the New York Times? Yeah, I wouldn't want to see it there. Don't do it. The fascinating engineering challenge of identifying the information and the rules needed for machines to do the right thing, I believe, will help human beings, make better decisions. Technology is forcing our hand, again, turning ethics from an improvised jazz performance into perhaps an exercise in performing a classical concerto. The stakes are high because those of us humans who have to make decisions for our organizations, we got to get better at this so our organizations can thrive long term. We do this so that we as individuals and we as a species can thrive as we avoid making decisions that ruin and break things. Anyway, the robots are forcing our hand. Did you ever notice, after any of the recent Star Trek movies or after any of the episodes on TV of Lost, the name of the director-producer J.J. Abrams' production company? He calls it Bad Robot. You've seen that. I had dinner with a guy the other day who set out to construct an actual bad robot. The creator of this ethically flawed robot is named Alexander Rybin. He's a roboticist and artist. Interesting combo, by the way. Alex set out to make a bad robot with bad ethics. You meet the robot, and based on some secret algorithm that was deliberately designed to make it impossible to reverse engineer and figure out how it makes this one crucial decision, what happens is not random, but you can't tell how it decided. You go up to this robot, which by itself, autonomously, decides whether or not it's going to produce a needle, which it uses to jab you to the point that you bleed. It's so annoying, needle. Alex made this robot for the sole purpose of violating Isaac Asimov's first law of robotics. You know the law, right? A robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. This is, we think, the first robot to autonomously and intentionally hurt a human. And if you're going to blame or sue someone for this assault, you'd go after Alex, the developer. But if they developed a machine commercially and it autonomously decided to do real harm, who would you blame? Who would you sue? Alex asked me these questions. Would I sue one of the 25 companies that helped build the thing? Which of the many engineers? Who is responsible for this thing making the right or wrong decision? It gets blurred. One way out of this conundrum is to study the rules by which the machine should behave and make sure those rules are disclosed and that the machine follows these rules. If you want, remove the word machine from that sentence and swap in the word people, and it turns into this. One way out of this conundrum is to study the rules by which people should behave and make sure those rules are disclosed and that the people follow them. We're at the point when technology can do deep learning of human systems, and this is starting to be able to reassemble the information into very complex systems of artificial intelligence. You don't believe me? This happened last week. Tall man with a beard came into my office with a laptop that had, this laptop, studied hundreds of movie scripts, which then, by itself, the machine on the laptop wrote a movie script. A not terrible movie script, to the point that it won honorable mention at a 48 hours challenge, a contest to make a short movie in 2 days. Software, driven by a neural network by itself, wrote an interesting enough script that was not filmed verbatim, but a script that a cast of human actors took and burnished into a real film starring that guy from the TV show Silicon Valley. Thomas Middleditch was in it. I don't know, it's about a space station and a love triangle. The critics called the film hilarious and intense. Which critics? Hollywood Reporter, New York Times? No. The Ars Technica, the geeky tech publication, said it was hilarious and intense. The machine looked at patterns of script making and made something original. So the machines are learning from us. We are teaching machines. We are learning from machines. They are teaching us about the stories that make interesting movies, or about how we want to distinguish right from wrong, or not just movies, but how we want to distinguish right from wrong in our machines, in our organizations, and in our lives. I hope you can now appreciate how machine ethics and human ethics are now intertwined. I'm so grateful that UNE and the folks organizing the Paul D. Merrill Lecture Series reached out to me and prompted me to think about these ethical issues. I had so much fun exploring the topic, and I hope you did too. Thank you. We're about to take questions, and there are these microphones that are here. I'm very proud of myself only for this. The only rules for my show in the morning are don't get facts wrong if you can help it. Don't libel anybody. Don't say any cucka words on the air. And you must end on time, and I have to end each and every one of these broadcasts, 100 a month, at 58 minutes and 58 seconds after the hour. And they told me to talk for 40, and it's pretty close. Thank you. Setting my benchmark low, at least he didn't go over. Got a question over here. Do me a favor, tell me your name, sir.
Sure, Arthur Fink. Very brief comment and a question. When I was studying artificial intelligence in grad school at Harvard, We were told, don't ask, can a machine think? Ask, can a machine cogitate?
To cogitate.
But question, suppose that I write such a system and write the control program for a robot, and that program gives the option to ask a user, which program do you want, which algorithm for crashes, and so forth. Where do you want to put the ethical responsibility? Is it on me as the writer? Is it on the person who makes those choices when they use it? Are you going to assign ethical responsibility to the robot itself in some way, or is there some other locus? I wonder if we're really talking about the ethics of robots or about the new ethical responsibility that we have as we develop them.
Yes. Yes. Just my luck that I have a guy who's an AI guy who studied at Harvard in the audience. No, listen, I mean, this is this issue, which is there's something in me, in the way that I like to think about investments, that I like to reward companies that are acting better than most according to my own ethical framework. You can't have companies that are perfect by every ethical framework. It might be you want to reward a company because it has broken the glass ceiling for women better than other peers in the industry, or that its carbon footprint is less, and so forth. And you can invest in that way. I have this instinct that I would like to be able to choose the ethics of an expensive machine that I'm buying. But David Bourne, who's the guy who really started the robotics program at Carnegie Mellon, when I suggested this interactive feature, he's the one who blanched, because he saw the legal implications, in which you decided to kill the pedestrians. That was you. I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, was that the right decision, my client? And he thinks it's impractical. But we want that discussion to be out in the open and disclosed so that if we're moving toward an industry standard about this stuff, that it's not just some men and women in a lab doing it quietly, and we end up with these marauding vehicles. But I think very much so that the interactiveness, the ability to choose, it's going to be an interesting debate about where the culpability and the liability lies. What's interesting, though, right, on my investment analogy, if you buy stock in a company that's awful, you're not responsible. Why not? But you're not. No one's going to come sue you because Amalgamated Sprinkle Works was dumping plutonium into the reservoir. You know, you're just the shareholder. And there sometimes is a disconnect between you own those companies. But maybe you get the penalty in the sense of if they pay a giant fine, your profits go down and your stock is worthless. Maybe that's how it works. Thank you for that question.
Hi, I'm Amanda, and I work at the art gallery on campus. And my question was more backward-looking in that, as somebody who studied history, have you thought about historical examples of the anxiety that comes with technologies in the past? Like you mentioned Westinghouse and Edison and that kind of a thing. And, you know, this worrying about technology and the ethical responsibility goes back like hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so I was just curious if you thought about that.
What a wonderful concluding question. Thank you for that. Often people, there are natural responses is to try to stop the technology from moving forward. It's moving too fast. I just got to believe, looking at the history of technology, that we can't stop this stuff. That's why we need to invite these discussions. How do you stop it? I think in the case of the so-called Luddites, they delayed it by pressuring Parliament to stop these machines from taking jobs for a little while, but it didn't stop it. Here's what we don't know right now. We don't know to what extent history is a guide, not so much about the ethics, but about what all the broader single ethical question about what all these machines will do to our well-being and our livelihoods. Let's say you couldn't stand the machines that were taking farm jobs in the 19th century. It's terrible. You lost your job. Apparently 98% of all agriculture jobs were destroyed by machines. But the country arguably is a better place because the increases of productivity afforded by the technology that came online, people moved into factory work, they were more productive, their pay went up, they lived better lives rather than spending all their time out in the sun with the backbreaking work of picking these crops, for instance. The question is now, will that same principle hold? It may. It may in the fullness of time, however you define that, mean that our jobs are better, less rote, less routine, less boring, because all the crap gets done by the machines that are especially good at the boring bits. But what if, as some argue, we're entering a point that, no, not entering a point, this is something in the future but not the unforeseeable future, in which we just need fewer humans to get the work done. And so we have, what do we do with people? And it's not such a fringe idea. People in Silicon Valley who are technologists, big famous ones, including Elon Musk, realize that a lot of their technology puts people out of work and employs people, but also puts them out of work, and they feel guilty about it. So they're proposing stuff that you need to read up on, subject for a different lecture, universal basic income, in which the government gives people supplements so that you can do what you love, like art that doesn't pay enough normally to get by. Maybe with the stipend, you can do it and be a more creative, fulfilled person. Bill Gates said something the technologists in the audience are going to keel over the other day, a robot tax. That's how much Bill Gates is worried about this. The countervailing argument came swiftly and brutally moments later. Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, writing in the Washington Post almost immediately, was like, this is a terrible idea. Where the heck did Gates get it? Where does it stop? Even an electric power drill is a labor-saving device. Do we tax that? And I was like, that's the argument that an undergrad's going to make. I was like, Larry, that's the best you got? Read the piece. It's more nuanced. But there's a grand ethical issue about the machines. Is it going to lift us up or lift some people up? If you are, 5 years ago, I talked to students at Carnegie Mellon who were studying robotics. I teased them 5 years ago. I said, doesn't your mother call all the time and say, why don't you study something that will lead to a real job? You must be awake at night. I'll never get work. And, of course, back then, none of them, no. So I followed up the other day with some of them. How you doing 5 years later? And everybody's spectacular. Anka Dragan, who's undergrad 5 years ago, is an assistant professor at UC Berkeley in robotics. David, I'm forgetting his name, young man from, I think, Kentucky, roboticist, studying robotics, has his own company in Pittsburgh that does modular portion bits that can be quickly wired into a custom robot. And so they're all doing fine. They all have wonderful math skills. They're doing great. Not everybody can do that. So what do we do with them? That is the subject of robot-proof jobs on your local public radio station starting in a couple of weeks. I am honored to have come home to Maine. What a brilliant audience. I've never stood in front of an audience with the depth of understanding that this one seems to have. And let's continue the conversation in the corridors here. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. If you missed all or part of today's Speaking in Maine, the program is available on our website, mainepublic.org, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward.